Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
Trade agreements, healthcare reform, auto emissions. The word of the day is renegotiation. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Adrienne Hill in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us this Thursday, April 27th. After a flurry of news reports that President Trump was considering pulling out of NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, he now says he wants to renegotiate. Improving it, though, could involve taking cues from another trade deal Trump bailed out of, the TPP, or Trans-Pacific Partnership. Marketplace's Annie Baxter reports.
NAFTA is not a perfect trade deal.
Well, first, the labor provisions in NAFTA and the environmental provisions are not enforceable in the same way that other provisions in NAFTA are.
Matt Gold teaches international trade law at Fordham University. He says NAFTA member countries cannot sue each other for violating labor and environmental standards the way they can with other grievances. And Gold says tweaking the deal could, for example, bolster Mexican workers' right to unionize and...
Child labor is another issue as well that the United States feels that Mexico is not fully fulfilling.
He says the U.S. got stronger labor and environmental enforcement provisions in the now abandoned Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP. It included the U.S., Mexico, Canada, and a number of Pacific Rim countries. Gold says that deal also had stronger intellectual property rights protections. And there were TPP provisions farm groups liked.
Commitment to transparency on government measures on biotechnology trade, information sharing, things of that nature.
Bob Young is chief economist with the American Farm Bureau Federation, a trade group. He'd like to see NAFTA establish clearer standards for approving genetically modified crops.
Just to make sure that we've kind of harmonized the approval process between the three countries.
That way, Mexico or Canada wouldn't reject our corn with new biotech traits, for example. But the Farm Bureau is more focused on trying to hold on to what NAFTA has already accomplished. Mexico and Canada are two of our top agricultural export markets. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Before the Affordable Care Act, Americans with pre-existing conditions faced a tough time getting and paying for health insurance. Today, under the ACA, people can't be charged more for those pre-existing conditions. But that could change. Republicans are still looking for a way to repeal and replace the health law. A new amendment would give some power to states, letting them decide whether insurers can charge people with pre-existing conditions more. From the health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein plays it out for us.
How bad could things be back in the day if you had a pre-existing condition? Pretty bad, says Georgetown's Sabrina Corlett.
We know before the Affordable Care Act that the premiums charged to sicker people could be as much as 9 times that would be charged to a younger person.
One thing lots of people like about Obamacare is that insurers can't do that anymore. Today, companies can only base premiums on your age, whether you smoke, where you live, and family size. But under this latest amendment, if states wanted, insurers could charge higher premiums on the sick if they lost coverage and didn't re-up within 2 months. But here's what people must remember.
This does not turn back the clock. This is not going back to the pre-ACA days.
That's Chris Condoleezza, an attorney and former Senate staffer. Condoleezza says the point is less to penalize people than it is to encourage them to remain insured. Easier said than done, says Georgetown's Corlett, especially since the Republican bill offers much skimpier subsidies to help people buy coverage in the first place.
These are folks who may not be able to hang on to their insurance, and when they try to get back into the market, they will be priced out.
Congressional Republicans understand that's a real risk. That's why they've required states to establish some kind of high-risk pool to help cover people's insurance costs. But historically, high-risk pools covered a fraction of people with pre-existing conditions and were chronically underfunded. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Another relatively quiet day on Wall Street today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All week long, we've been bringing you snapshots of current economic opinion from our nationwide survey, the Marketplace Edison Research Poll. Today, we take a closer look at manufacturing. Turns out, even though most Americans don't have jobs making things in factories, a lot of people agree about the primacy of manufacturing to the economy. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
I'm at Schoolhouse Electric, a custom lighting manufacturer in Portland, Oregon. More than 100 workers here make lamps, vintage wall clocks, chandeliers.
I've been a cook, I've been a union organizer, I've also been a construction worker, and now I work in manufacturing.
Cindy Chan is 46. She started but didn't finish college. Among all her jobs, she says this is the most rewarding and stable.
This is a pretty decent wage, and I've gotten some raises. I can see working here till I retire.
Mitchell Parrish has never worked in a factory. He has a liberal arts degree and a marketing job promoting rock concerts in Burlington, Vermont. But the 25-year-old, who was surveyed in our poll, shares Chan's view.
Manufacturing is crucial for a lot of people. Looking for steady jobs, consistent income, benefits.
His opinion aligns with the 80% of respondents in our poll who say manufacturing is very or somewhat important to their local economy.
As a matter of economics, they're wrong.
Labor economist Michael Strain at the American Enterprise Institute points out manufacturing only provides 8.5% of jobs in America. It was 25% back in 1970.
What's important is that people have good jobs where they can earn a good wage, healthcare jobs, or firefighter or a police officer. It's not obvious to me that working in a factory is any more important.
But Rob Scott at the Economic Policy Institute says actually factory jobs are more important.
Not only do they have higher wages, especially for non-college educated workers than most jobs in other industries, but they also have great benefits.
Scott says companies that make things punch above their weight economically.
The wages paid, also the purchases of goods and services by manufacturing, it's about 35% of the total GDP, much bigger than any other private sector of the economy.
Still, manufacturing jobs are vulnerable to competition from cheap foreign labor. In fact, 70% of our poll respondents support raising taxes on companies that move U.S. manufacturing jobs overseas. Though that doesn't mean consumers will dig into their own pockets and pay higher prices to buy stuff made in the USA. Mitchell Parrish says he'll pick up a cheap T-shirt.
And I look on the tag and it says made in China. That doesn't bother me.
Which is one reason most of those important manufacturing jobs making clothing in America have moved abroad. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
If you want to know more about our poll, we've got a video with highlights, also a short quiz to see where you fall on the economic stress spectrum. It's over on our website, marketplace.org. The unicorn frappuccino, a pink and blue concoction from Starbucks, was all over social media last week. I missed out. But it's the latest in a parade of brightly colored Instagram-friendly foods making the rounds. Kimberly Egan is a partner at CCD Innovation. She researches food trends. Kimberly, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Where did this rainbow unicorn trend start?
I would say it started with Adeline Waugh, who is a blogger. She has the Vibrant and Pure blog, and she created a cream cheese toast colored with chlorophyll and beetroot, which are very natural colorings, and she called it unicorn toast, and then all of a sudden it just took off and morphed into this crazy confectionery place.
How do we go from a healthful piece of cream cheese-covered toast to a giant pink sugar bomb from Starbucks?
Well, I think part of it is culturally driven. I think that what's happening with this trend, we're calling it a unicorn trend. I actually would ladder it up to an escapism trend. And because, you know, the world is kind of a funny place right now. There's lots of uncertainty going on. And I think especially with the millennials, they are very much a driver to this trend. They want to escape. And this unicorn escapism is a wonderful way to do it.
Is this that different from a food trend like kale or bacon that preceded it, which seemed to sort of stick with us for a long time?
I would say that this is more of a fad than a trend.
Okay.
A fad tends to peak very early and then drop off suddenly, where a trend builds over time. And what I think it represents is this escapism trend. So what else is going on within this world is galaxy donuts and mermaid toast. And
wait, you got to stop there and tell me what those things are. I'm not familiar with galaxy donuts or mermaid toast.
So galaxy donuts are basically donuts that have sort of dark icing on them, and that they represent planets, and they are showing up in sort of these boutique donut shops around the country. And then mermaid toast is essentially a cream cheese toast, but then colored in blues and greens, and it's just another way to articulate this need for escape.
What prediction do you have for the next big food trend? Once we move beyond rainbow colors and bright pinks and galaxy donuts, where are we going?
I really, really do believe this alternative proteins is a next big food trend. So we had plant-based protein. We have the manufactured or engineered proteins with Impossible Foods. But I would say that insect protein and alternative proteins outside of plants is going to be another big food trend coming at us.
So next year we'll be having a sort of insect-infused frappe from Starbucks?
You may have insect sprinkles on the top. No, but I will guarantee you are going to be eating chips made from crickets.
Kimberly Egan is the partner at CCD Innovation. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Take care.
Coming up, The Handmaid's Tale on Hulu.
Just that feeling of powerlessness against the changes of government. And I think that this is just a very extreme version of that.
So who's the audience? But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average up 6 points, pretty flat, to finish at 20,981. The Nasdaq rose 23 points, 0.3%, to close at 6048, and the S&P 500 added just 1 point, barely changed, to end at 2388. PayPal clicked up 6.1% after it announced another strong quarter. Visa gave up 0.2%, while MasterCard added 0.8%. Sports clothes maker Under Armour reported a loss, but still managed to impress traders today. They'd expected worse. Shares jumped almost 10%. Nike was up 0.5%, as was Columbia Sportswear. The shares of Raytheon, maker of Tomahawk missiles, reached an all-time high at one point, finishing up 0.6%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.29%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
From news to numbers, you count on Marketplace to explain what you need to know. Get Marketplace delivered to your inbox every day and never miss a beat. Subscribe to the newsletter at marketplace.org.
This is Marketplace. I'm Adrienne Hill. Members of a powerful automaker lobby met with top officials in the Trump administration today, including EPA head Scott Pruitt. They are, shall we say, reviewing fuel economy rules from President Obama. 6 weeks ago, President Trump announced he'd reopen those rules to put an end to what he called an assault on the American auto industry. But rolling back regulations is going to take some work. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong reports.
Here's the plan President Trump has ordered reviewed. In model year 2022, every carmaker's fleet would have to average 54 miles a gallon. The past administration found that regular gas cars can accomplish that at reasonable cost. More than 20 peer-reviewed studies went into that finding. To undo that, Trump bureaucrats would have to introduce contrary evidence. Vehicle analyst Dave Cook is with the Union of Concerned Scientists.
They're going to have to find some new analysis that wasn't considered and some new reasoning that would somehow justify that decision.
Which he figures could take months, followed by proposals, public comment, and if any data seem dodgy, opponents will sue. But even if the administration gets its way, it has a problem. California has a waiver for stricter standards, and 13 states have signed on. Ann Carlson teaches environmental law at UCLA.
California's already indicated that it's going to fight the Trump administration. It's already on record reconfirming its commitment to the later year auto standards.
The automakers complain that they'd have to spend $200 billion to meet the Obama standards. And they say consumers today prefer guzzlers. Here's Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers head Mitch Bainwall at a recent Senate hearing.
And in a low gas price environment, consumers are moving away from the stated social objectives of electrification and smaller cars.
For all the controversy, the automakers and the White House indicate they want to cut some deal for one uniform system. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Among the parts of the federal government the Trump administration wants to shrink is the Department of Education. There's a $9 billion cut to the department's budget on the table, 13% overall, which could mean trimming services, programs, and jobs. But firing people is more complicated than just handing out pink slips. Politico spotted the Education Department has hired outside experts to help train them on how to downsize. Marketplace's Rima Krais checks it out.
Yep, that's right. The Department of Education is spending money, about $28,000, to, well, save money.
It's incredibly ironic.
Don Kettle is a public policy professor at the University of Maryland.
One of the reasons why they need contractors is that the actual rules themselves are so incredibly complex.
He's talking about the federal rules an agency needs to follow to shrink down. They're outlined in a mind-numbing 119-page document, heavy with arcane rules and jargon.
Here's the way that you can identify the people that you want to try to release. Here's how you have to notify them. Here are the rights and appeals that they have. Here are the bumping rights that they have. You can't lay off too many veterans.
In Washington speak, this is called a reduction in force. And Kettle says there hasn't been a government-wide reduction in more than a decade. So most agencies aren't familiar with it. Ron Sanders is a former associate director of the Office of Personnel Management. He says at the heart of the rules is this very simple idea.
The last person hired is the first person to go. And in many agencies, that has a disproportionate effect on women and minorities.
We have a legacy system that was designed for a different age.
Max Steyer heads up the Partnership for Public Service. He says the rules should rely more on employee performance. Also,
there is, I think, some focus on trying to reduce the headcount in government before understanding, you know, what you're trying to get done and then how best to do it. And I think that's the wrong ordering.
He says the reductions in force are easier in theory than in practice. Workers appeal. And the savings? They don't appear until much later. I'm Rima Krais for Marketplace.
Premiered the first three episodes of The Handmaid's Tale. The TV show, based on the book by Margaret Atwood, is set in a dystopian America with a totalitarian government in charge. It's a world where women have been stripped of their right to control their bodies, to work, to have their own money.
I have $4,000 in that account. They can't just take it.
We made it easy. All they needed to do was just push a few buttons. Alyssa heard there's a new law. Women can't own property anymore.
Wait, what?
Bruce Miller is the showrunner and creator of The Handmaid's Tale. Thanks for being with us.
It's my pleasure to be here.
So what drew you to this story in the first place?
I read this book when I was actually in college, so in a new fiction class, which tells you how long ago I was in college. And it was really one of the first books I read that made me feel like I was starting to understand how to be a writer. That, this is how you put words together into a story. And It was one of those books that always seemed like very, you know, no matter when you read it, it was relevant. It was perennially relevant. And then I heard tell that there was a TV series coming along, and I was all excited just as a fan of the book, you know, excited to see the TV series, and kind of never really happened. So I started to have, as I got kind of more into writing television, I had my agent keep checking to see if the rights were available, which they never were. But after 8 or 9 years of those phone calls, eventually they said they're looking for someone to come in and, you know, write a new pilot and run the show. And I guess pure enthusiasm and, you know, 30 years of thinking about it paid off.
How did it wind up on Hulu?
Well, most of that took place before I came onto the project. It was a Showtime project originally through MGM. And then Showtime decided not to do it. And I guess there was some sort of, you know, competition, some sort of bidding war for the project. And Hulu won. So I think Hulu was looking for a project they could find a way to sink their teeth into. And so, you know, that happens above and beyond my pay grade, thank God, because all that's those decisions are seemingly quite complicated, and I never know how they end up making money off of TV streaming. It all just seems so complicated, but luckily I don't have to think too much about that.
What do you make of the political reaction we've seen to the show? I saw the Hollywood Reporter called it the most unintentionally relevant show ever.
Not completely unintentionally. I hope we tried to make it relevant anyway. But in terms of its political, I mean, I think everybody sees it in a different way. For me, I just see it as just that feeling of powerlessness against the changes of government. And I think that this is just a very extreme version of that.
When did you guys finish the show?
We finished the show in February.
Okay.
So it was, you know, very much, you know, all the scripts were written and most of our filming was done well before the inauguration. And I do think that even after Trump was elected president, that there was a question about what that was going to mean. And during the time between the election and the inauguration, I think it was more up in the air. I think since the inauguration, things have come more into concrete focus. And so there have been more parallels between the work that we did and what's going on in the real world since then. But I didn't know that was coming. We followed the story that we had and certainly followed Margaret Atwood's prescience more than tried to look and say, you know, this is what's about to happen in America. I mean, instead, we just looked at what was happening around the world the same way Margaret did.
Do you think the fact that the show has become so politicized works in the show's favor, or do you worry it could turn off part of the potential audience?
Well, I certainly think it could turn off people from watching it because it, you know, it's not a show that's based on the political times now. It's a show that was based on, you know, Margaret Atwood would say, on the some of the struggles with the rise of evangelical politics in the 80s. So I certainly wouldn't want people not to watch because they think it's just a metaphor digging at their decision or their candidate or their point of view, because none of that is, you know, it certainly wasn't the intention. And I think of it much more as a character piece and a survival story and, you know, an incredible woman in this horribly misogynistic, you know, anti-woman environment.
These are anxious times in the country. And we've talked a lot on the show about sort of entertainment as escapism more than anything these days. And I wonder for you, is The Handmaid's Tale the kind of show you want to sit down on the couch and watch at the end of the day?
I don't look at TV as escapism or entertainment as escapism. I just want to feel something. I want to feel along with these characters.
Yeah.
And I can absolutely understand. I mean, I would have constructed a very different show if I thought everybody was going to watch all the episodes in one day. Hulu's model is to drop an episode a week. And it was the very first question I had for them is, how is this going to be distributed? Because, you know, it's heavy stuff. The book is heavy stuff. But I worked on ER for a while, and one of the things I loved about the show was when it was done, you needed like half a glass of scotch to get to sleep. And and to me, you know, it was, you know, memorable. And I certainly, you know, am not in the despair business. I mean, I think it's a very hopeful show. And actually, I think even though tough to watch sometimes, it's supposed to be entertaining. Just like I think the book is incredibly entertaining, even though it's got heavy themes and horrible things happening. It's just, you know, a deep dive into a world, and it's very, very interesting and satisfying.
But maybe that scotch can help afterwards before bed.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I would definitely recommend that.
Bruce Miller is creator and showrunner of The Handmaid's Tale. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Final note before we finish up today. Buffalo Wild Wings announced it would cut jobs and costs to the tune of about $40 million or so over the next 2 years. The company says it's facing, quote, the unique headwind of chicken wing price inflation, which I can hardly say with a straight face. The chain expects the price of chicken wings could jump 10% this year. Given that, Bloomberg reports Buffalo Wild Wings is looking for other foods to promote, taking some of the focus off wings, which is tricky business when wings are in your name. But what else is there to do confronted with chicken wing price inflation headwinds? Today, the Dow finished up 6 points, pretty flat. The Nasdaq rose 23 points, 0.3%. And the S&P 500 added just 1 point, barely changed. John Buckley, Deirdre Dettke, Eve Epstein, Danielle Irby, Suzanne Levy, Betsy Streisand, and Eve Tro are the Marketplace editing staff. Our interim managing editor is John Gordon. I'm Adrienne Hill. Kai's back tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.